Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Keith Phipps
and
Genevieve Kosky.
Tasha Robinson is off somewhere filling her burritos with roughage, but she'll join us again in the new year. In the first half of this conversation, we talked about The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Jacques Demy's bittersweet French musical about young love and the disruptions of fate. On this episode, we'll shift to Damien Chazelle's La La Land, which counts The Umbrellas of Cherbourg among its many influences. Though La La Land does pay homage to classic Hollywood musicals, the relationship between Mia, a struggling actress played by Emma Stone, and Sebastian, a struggling jazz man played by Ryan Gosling, follows a similar arc to Guy and Genevieve's relationship with The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Like Guy and Genevieve, Mia and Sebastian fall madly in love with each other and express that love in a number of charming song and dance numbers. And like Guy and Genevieve, Mia and Sebastian drift apart when other aspects of their lives command their attention. Sebastian feels pressure to make a practical living from his talent as a jazz pianist, so he signs on with a popular jazz fusion outfit that takes him on the road and away from Mia. Meanwhile, Mia takes bold steps to pursue her dreams in Hollywood, which opens up the distance between them even further. And like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, they both wind up in a good place, more or less, just not with each other. We're left to imagine what might have been. We'll talk about the virtues of La La Land after the break, and later we'll bring The Umbrellas of Cherbourg back into the picture to discuss the connections between the two movies. Please stay with us.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You're an actress.
Yeah.
You could write your own roles, something that's as interesting as you are.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to have my own club. I'm going to play whatever we want.
Is that going to happen every time?
I think so.
This is the dream. It's conflict and it's compromise. It's very, very exciting.
Okay, so Keith and Genevieve, La La Land appears to be an Oscar juggernaut, topping many best of lists, including Uproxx's Izzes.
Yes.
And, you know, winning the New York Film Critics Circle, getting plenty of acclaim, and some detractors, of course, as well. What did the two of you make of it? Does it live up to the hype?
Well, the hype was quite large, so I don't know that I can say that, but I did really love this movie while being keenly aware throughout that it was a love that would probably not last appropriately. But yeah, like, this is a film that really carries you along with it. And then afterward, I really had trouble remembering what I liked about it. Like, I had to watch it again right before this podcast just to like kind of remind myself of it, because it's kind of like a feeling that you dip into for 2 hours. And then when it's over, you're like left with kind of the echoes of that very touching ending, but everything that comes before it, I feel, is kind of obliterated by that ending.
Yeah, I kind of have the same experience. I've seen La La Land twice. I saw it at Toronto, and I saw it again on a screener. And it's a thing where it's so exciting and lovely, and it works firing on all cylinders. It works completely when you watch it. And then it does have that strange sensation afterwards of just feeling like sand between your fingers. Mm-hmm. You just wonder, like, what am I left with here? Is this? It's not really fair to La La Land that we've brought Umbrellas of Cherbourg in to the picture. It's never going to have that kind of depth. But is this the thing with Chazelle? Maybe. I mean, Whiplash almost left me the same way. Just like absolutely riveted, totally impressed by his command of style, by the vibrancy of the emotions and the filmmaking. But is there something there? Is there there?
I think it's a terrific movie. I mean, it's on my top 10 list, although I think it's number 7 on my top 10 list. And when I showed it to the editor-in-chief of Uprox, who saw the film twice in one day, he's like, I don't understand why it's not number 1. Well, I think the problem is, you know, I've seen Umbrellas of Cherbourg, you know. Yeah.
Singing in the Rain.
I've seen other sources of inspiration, and it synthesizes them really well. This is a really just a remarkable piece of filmmaking, like every shot. It's like,
the technical achievement cannot really be understated here.
Yeah. And like, I wrote this somewhere, but it's like, this is someone who had waited all his life to throw everything he wanted to do in a musical into one movie, and he did it all. But you can kind of feel the effort a little bit, you know, at times. And I say all this saying, I think it's a terrific movie. I've seen this movie twice. The first time I left, like, just on a complete high from seeing it. This is really something. Watching it again on the screener, I really liked it a lot still. But I think maybe some of the infatuation drains away a little bit after the first viewing. I can see that, but I don't want to diminish it. And I'm keeping my distance from the inevitable. And you know, you can see it coming 10 miles away. La La backlash. Oh, La La backlash. It's enveloping film Twitter.
I've said this a couple times, but I do kind of suspect that this is fated to be the artist of this year.
No. But I didn't mind the artist, and I like this more than the artist.
Yeah,
I
just mean in terms of like the praise heaped upon it, and then kind of the immediate fading out of the conversation. Fascination with an older form of entertainment.
The point is that it is reviving. It's introducing a lot of people to an experience that they haven't had before.
So,
film people are territorial about those things.
Let me keep a little more praise on this too. It is not a musty, the artist, which I like, you know, but it's a stunt, you know, let's revive this for see what it looks like and see how it plays. And we did something really cool here. I think this does a really good job of making a contemporary musical. You know, I mean, these are not the realistic struggles of artists in LA right now. But I think it does a good job of making what two people in the situation experience and making it big and making it splashy and, you know, blowing it up and making the conflicts, you know, super broad in a way that musicals always have. That's how musicals work, you know. And I think there's more that makes it feel present and something that happened about what's going on now than the Prius jokes. I think it's a very good modern musical.
And I do want to push back a little bit against something you said, Scott, about it not having the depth or nuance of Umbrellas. And I do think one thing La La Land achieves that Umbrellas doesn't is showing us why its central characters are together. Not to get too much into Umbrellas up front here, but when we meet Guy and Genevieve, like, they're already in love, you know, and we don't necessarily see the foundation of their relationship being laid, and the problems that they face as a couple are very kind of big, broad problems about being separated, basically, whereas the issues that Sebastian and Mia are facing are much more specific to them as characters, and I think more nuanced in terms of kind of what it is to be an artist and to make a living and et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, the two films are obviously kind of functioning in different spheres in that regard. And I think La La Land definitely works in sort of the broader, heightened universe it's functioning in. But I don't want you to slag on La La Land in that way, because there is something deep going on in that relationship, even though I don't love all the aspects of that relationship.
A little bit. I mean, there is, in terms of their courtship, I mean, it's a little cute. You know, I mean, I like it. We've got two.
Oh, you mean when they dance among the stars?
No. I mean, earlier than that, because you have this friction between them, and then they finally, it's one of those type of love stories where their first encounter is
we get the meet cute.
We get it like three times or something
they don't like each other at all.
No, but you know,
then they do.
Yes, it's one of those things. But
even that feels meta. you know, in the context of this movie that is so obsessed with these classic Hollywood tropes, the way that they meet and their relationship forms is nodding to those tropes.
And yeah, and of course, then you have a scene, them recreating a sequence out of Rebel Without a Cause, or at least going to the Griffith Observatory and playing around in that territory. I mean, I guess I disagree with Keith a little bit in thinking about this as a modern musical, because I think it just so much has its foot in the past, and and the dreams that they have, they're kind of retro dreams in a way, because you know, you've got the
Emma Stone. Oh, you mean the jazz musician?
Yeah, exactly. The jazz music, the jazz musician who wants to revive this old form, or the Emma Stone. I mean, certainly now, as in the past, there were people go to Hollywood. Young people go to Hollywood chasing their dreams, but that kind of a character, that ingenue type Hollywood character, is an old type as well. And then, of course, you know, the film is constantly kind of going back to classic Hollywood locations and, you know, studio backlots, which are things, again, you associate more with the past than the present.
I got a call back.
What? Come on! For what?
For a TV show. The one that I was telling you about. Earlier.
The Dangerous Minds meets the OC?
Yeah.
Congratulations, that's
really
incredible.
Exciting. I feel like I said negative stuff about it before.
What?
It's like Rebel Without a Cause, sort of.
I got the bullets.
Yes.
You've never seen it.
I've never seen it.
Oh, my. You know it's playing at the Rialto.
Really?
Yes. You should go. I mean, I can take you.
Okay.
You know, for research.
For research?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Monday night, 10 o'clock.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
For research.
To go back even further to a point, my reaction to the film when I first saw it was, it was kind of exciting because my thought was like, people are just going to flip out over this movie because they won't have seen anything like it. And I think Damien Chazelle knows that to a degree, which is why he can just pilfer relentlessly from the best musicals of all time, because many people will not have seen it or experienced a musical in the very classic, you know, made for the movie sense that La La Land is.
Yeah, we've had musicals, but they tend to be adaptations.
Yeah, and I think the staging of those musicals is usually just atrocious. I mean, you look at like a Mamma Mia. Or
I was going to say, I'm waiting for you to say Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia, I can't say. That's my go-to example, but or Hairspray or something, and it's just...
What if you have people who don't know how to make a movie, much less a movie musical?
Yeah. The Producers is another one. It's just, let's have the person who staged it on Broadway do the movie version. It's like, no, that's a really bad idea. It's going to look like a stage version on the screen, and it's going to just seem leaden, and that's usually what happens. But this is so far from that.
You want to talk about Les Mis?
Oh my God.
It's the opposite of Les Mis, though, because like, Les Mis is so uncinematic, and so many. I mean, the Anne Hathaway scene obviously works well, and the one scene in the movie that really works, but you know, you don't go to musicals for close ups.
It's like Les Miserables. It's like this visual strategy stinks for the whole movie, and then you get one scene where that visual strategy pays off, and that's the big number for her. But in any case, you know, none of those films feel like La La Land does. And, you know, we've seen other films that have paid homage to classic musicals or tried to work some sort of modern variation on them, like Everyone Says I Love You, for example, which sort of plays up the amateurishness of the actors who are singing or not really singers, etc. But this doesn't do that either. This really kind of moves forward as if the musical genre isn't completely dead. And I appreciate that. You know, it's exciting for me, and I think for us as fans of classic Hollywood musicals, but I think for many audiences, it's going to be a total revelation because they'll just simply have not seen anything like it.
And let's not undersell either. It's a really good musical. I mean, from the first scene where the camera is sweeping along the highway, I think that's your least favorite scene, but whatever, I like it. and the songs are really good too. I mean, you could play these and enjoy them out of context and be perfectly happy.
Yeah, I mean, that opening number, which Scott apparently hates.
I like the choreography more than the song.
Yeah, I actually kind of agree with that, and I'm not enamored of most of the songs in this film, actually.
Really? Not even Here to the Dreamers? Come on, Here to the Dreamers?
Yeah, I mean, Emma Stone's big number is, it's her big number, and it's good, and I mean, I do like the recurring City of Stars motif a lot, and I've been hearing my boyfriend plink it out on the piano in the 2 weeks since we saw this movie, so I'm very familiar with it. But yeah, that opening number is is such a stylistic throwback where you do have this big opening number that is just setting the scene. It's not about introducing the characters or kicking off the plot. It's just a big celebratory song and dance number that opens the film. And it's a bold move in 2016 to do that. And I respect it. I honestly don't know that it really works of a piece with the movie. It feels a little more like, look at what I'm doing here. But I respect that he went there, and I respect the choreography of it and just the ambition of that opening number.
I like everything but the actual song and the singing in that number, because I do think that sequence is important and clever in taking the thing that everyone complains about LA, the worst aspect of LA, according to everyone who lives there, which is the traffic. And
I hadn't heard that.
And then makes it recontextualize it as this land of enchantment, LA, even if you're in this terrible situation, this miserable place, this, you know, traffic jam that goes on forever, this 8.5 situation, you're about to see LA transformed into a magical place. So I like that sentiment.
Is the weirdest number in this movie Start a Fire, though, because you don't bring John Legend in to do a crappy musical mm-hmm. number, but at the same time, you're supposed to understand yeah. that he's just not into this music. You know, it's very odd. It's yeah. not a bad song.
No, I kind of like the jazz fusion
yeah, sure.
number.
I don't think you're supposed to think of it as bad. I think yeah. you're supposed to think of it as not him. It's an odd tension the film has to work.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought of it as bad. And I was, and it
well,
made me,
the film
it,
wants
it,
you to think of
and
it
made
as
me,
bad.
And it made me think, like, why is John Legend doing this? Why would he want to be participating in what is a fairly sophisticated musical number in which it is in the context of being kind of tacky? Like, it's basically just a step above the samba tapas place.
I mean, this is Damien Chazelle. Clearly, jazz is important to him. Clearly, the Sebastian character is a kind of a avatar for him. Mm-hmm. Can we all acknowledge that Sebastian is also pretty insufferable? Like,
it helps you have Ryan Gosling playing.
Yeah, but John Legend's character has a point. Jazz yeah. does need to evolve.
Well, I think he's treated as a little insufferable too.
Yeah,
just in that and on second viewing, the whole, you taught me to listen to jazz, you taught me to appreciate something, thanks, dude. You know, yeah. it's a little condescending.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a purist. And I think what is interesting about their relationship is when they each try to kind of adopt the other's approach to their work and their life, they fail, because she tries to live up to his ideal of like pure artistry by like writing this one woman show and no one comes and she fails, and he like lands this practical job and, you know, makes a living, and it, you know, we're led to believe it kind of kills him inside. So like there's kind of a subtle suggestion here that there are different approaches to being an artist, and what works for one person may not work for another person.
Or alternately, she adopts his way of doing things and succeeds with the one person she needs to succeed with, and it kind of opens up the future to her. And he takes on her more commercial, practical approach, and he's miserable for a couple of years and buys up and gets the club that he wanted all yeah. along, you know? So
You know, we talk about the melancholy ending here, but I mean, it really is a tremendously happy ending for both of them in terms of everything other than their relationship. But like the circumstances that lead to her becoming a huge movie star are really strange. Like, you know, she's one of eight people at her one woman show, happens to be a big time casting director who wants to build a movie around her, you know? Like, it's
basically if Mike Lee were a hugely successful Hollywood director, like sort of like we'll improvise this and build the characters together kind of movie.
Yeah. And I mean, that certainly fits with the like Hollywood fairy tale tone and, you know, the happily ever after aspect, which is, it's nice that it is undercut with that melancholy of them not being able to achieve their dreams together. But you know, the way by which it gets there is unrealistic, let's say. Realism is not exactly this movie's stock and trade.
One point I made when I first saw the film, a piece I wrote for Gentleman's Quarterly, is that the whole
thing. Which Genevieve is not allowed to read, apparently.
I've written for them, but I'm not allowed to read them.
Gentleman's Quarterly. I just like calling them gentlemen. GQ.com just seems not as fancy as Gentleman's Quarterly. But one point I was making is that the whole jazz thing is another meta moment of the movie, which is, you know, so many people say, I hate jazz, and they don't know what jazz mm-hmm. is. And so he introduces Emma Stone to what jazz is. But what's being commented on there is really, I hate musicals, mm-hmm. which is what mm-hmm. people say. And now Damien Chazelle is going to show us through La La Land what a real musical looks like. To me, that's the real subtext of that yeah. conversation, is Chazelle being able to forward the movie that we're seeing as something authentic and something to love and something that pays tribute to the real Hollywood musical.
Yeah, I think the whole jazz is dying thing is also coded for movies in some ways as well, but it's a bigger thing. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, and it gets even more explicit with that conversation where Mia is kind of fretting about her one-woman show, and she says, it feels really nostalgic to me, which is a weird thing to say about your own work, but we'll go with it for the purposes of this meta exercise that Chazelle clearly is wanting to engage in here. She says, it feels really nostalgic to me, and Sebastian says, that's the point. And she says, are people going to like it? And his response is, F 'em, you know, which is certainly in keeping with that character, but not necessarily with the tone of the film, which does seem to want to be liked more than that sentiment would suggest.
Yeah, from the beginning, too. I mean, yeah. it definitely wants to knock you out with its style and, yeah. and pizzazz, and it's not a modest achievement, and not, I don't know, it doesn't have that kind of like soulful quality. It's yeah. like, it's really splashy. But there's going to be a lot of aspects of this film that we're going to want to compare to Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and so we're going to do that in a minute. We'll be right back to talk about it in Connections. Now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. As I said in the introduction to this episode, Mia and Sebastian's story follows a similar arc to Guy and Genevieve's story in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Broadly put, they fall madly in love in the first half, but their relationship falls apart in the second. So we can talk about that and know, you know, the various other things that connect these two films. But to kind of carry over from the previous segment and go right to the end of the film, mm-hmm. do we feel in some way that Sebastian's situation mirrors Genevieve's in some respect? I mean, I think we can feel that Mia's ending is a happy ending. She has everything that she yeah. could possibly want. But I am at least a little bit haunted by the image of Sebastian being that lone piano man in yeah. the shadows, you know, watching, you know, the woman that he loved go away. He isn't found. He doesn't have his yeah. Madeline.
He has to walk by a giant billboard of her face every day to get into his club. Thought that was a particularly gutting touch.
But is that character wired for long-term relationships? Mm. I mean, this is someone who's very much in love with his own infatuation with music and reviving and keeping this flame alive. And I don't know, ultimately, if you know, we don't see what drives him apart, but I wouldn't be surprised if that didn't play into it in some way.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't really consider that when watching that ending, just as I didn't necessarily consider Genevieve as being sad at the end of Umbrellas, but that sort of the imbalance between the two parties in terms of where they've ended up and how they feel about it is, it adds an interesting wrinkle to both of these endings.
Well, and I think there's something, here's where La La Land is modern, in my opinion, compared to Umbrellas, and it's that love is not enough. In the modern world, you need a different kind of fulfillment, and that fulfillment for both of these characters is realizing their dreams, not necessarily being happy together, being happy with someone, or that sort of thing. I mean, I guess to a certain point, Guy, in his, you know, very modest way, does realize his dreams. They're Mia and Sebastian's dreams are more far flung, but the premium that is placed on those dreams, those ambitions that may take you away, or in this case do take you away from somebody you care a great deal about, it's a very modern thing, is it not? To put your career above everything, above including love.
Yeah, well, I mean, these two movies are functioning in different eras with different societal expectations placed on the two genders, you know. And in Umbrellas, you know, we're not given any dreams for Genevieve beyond being with Guy, you know? She doesn't, like, want to take over the umbrella store or anything, you know? Like, she wants to have a child with Guy, you know? That is the extent of her dreams. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's obviously regressive to a certain extent, but it works in the context of the film.
Yeah, 1964.
But by virtue of taking place in the present day and just taking place in the entertainment world where, like, dreams are kind of hardwired into you if you're in that world, mm-hmm. you know, you don't go to Hollywood because you want to, like, get married and have a kid necessarily, you know. The more we talk about it, the more I think La La Land is a much richer film than I perhaps gave it credit for. It's just dealing in these very kind of familiar tropes. But then again, so is Umbrellas. It's just kind of the style with which they do it that differs.
I like scenes like where they start to kind of drift apart and then come back together. You know, they get back together when Sebastian gets wind of this opportunity and mm-hmm. goes to find her.
Yeah.
And then they have a scene, I believe, after that where it's like, so where are we?
Yeah, that's actually...
where is this relationship now?
Yeah, I wanted to bring up that scene as kind of like a key difference in between these two movies, because the two characters actually talk about their relationship and they come to a mutual agreement to part ways, which is vastly different from what happens in Umbrellas, which is sadder in a lot of ways, just because there is no... I don't want to say closure, because I don't think they have closure necessarily in La La Land, but it's out of their control in a way that it's not in La La Land. And I think that's important in terms of establishing this relationship between me and Sebastian as something worthwhile that had an effect on both of them and left a mark on both of them. And I think that's only maybe hinted at in Umbrellas. It's made explicit in La La Land.
That also, it's a modern touch too, the whole where are we conversation. Mm-hmm. That's not a conversation that characters in the last act of a classical musical have. Right. They know where they are.
There's no big where are we number. Yeah.
They're singing and smooching at that point, you know? And this, for as much as this is that type of film, it's not that type of film.
Yeah.
Is there anything else to say comparing these two endings? Because they do echo each other a little bit. I mean, I think there's kind of the one thing La La Land has that's different is that has this kind of 25th hour ending.
Mm-hmm. Last Temptation of Christ.
Last Temptation of Christ, where it's like you're going to get, you know, what if something happened just a little different? How mm-hmm. would things go? And so we get that kind of fantasy.
It's sort of a heightened fantasy within a heightened fantasy, which I thought was really kind of an interesting, sophisticated way to do this, too. It's like this is a movie that's already kind of in a loftier sphere in terms of the way it's playing out this drama, and then you get the sort of the musical version of the musical you're already watching in some ways. Yeah. You get the American in Paris kind of ballet.
It's like 25th hour combined with American in Paris.
Combined with Umbrellas of Cherbourg, combined with The Last Temptation of Christ, I guess. I think this film, La La Land, I think it sags a little in the middle, but I think the end overwrites a lot of that. I mean, I love the audition number, and I love the last stretch of this. I think it's just a wonderful piece of filmmaking. All that being said, it's not the end of Umbrella this year. Boring, you know.
One other thing these endings do have in common is they both take place at winter. And we haven't really mm-hmm. talked about the structure of La La Land and how it is divided into seasons in a way that is similar and perhaps nodding to the way that Umbrellas is divided into parts.
Yeah.
And there's a time jump at the end. But it's interesting that La La Land is divided into seasons, but it's not necessarily sequential seasons. You know, and by placing it in L.A., where there kind of are no seasons,
right.
I feel like that's a really interesting and probably purposeful way to organize the film, because the seasons become kind of metaphorical for the status of their relationship.
Because what we see is LA no matter what.
Right. So, you know, it begins in spring when their love begins to take root, and then it's in full bloom in summer, and then things start to get a little more difficult in autumn, and then winter is where this melancholy re-meeting happens. Just like in Umbrellas, you know, that movie is so associated in my mind with, like, that snow globe, mm-hmm. as you put a scene, but it's just that one scene at the end that takes place in winter, you know, at Christmas time. I'd go so far as to say a purposeful echo there in La La Land in terms of staging that melancholic reconciliation during winter.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The other thing I liked about the ending of La La Land is that it has this almost like contrast of tones between the sequence within the sequence and the sequence itself. Because when you do get to that fantasy scene about what might have been, that's when Chazelle just completely hits the gas. It's just this wonderful montage that's just lighter than air, and then when you come out of it, the melancholic qualities of the scene that you enter are tug on you all the more, because the tone is just downshifted from this high that you've been on, which is a nice touch. So I think the film definitely has some pretty good closing speed. So one of the differences between the two movies has to do with the singing. The La La Land is a live singing, and
it's not live. They're not singing live on camera, but it's voice. the actors' voices,
and it's not so much in Umbrella's Cherbourg. How did that play for you?
I mean, I don't know how much aware you are watching Umbrella's Cherbourg that the voices are dubbed. Yeah. I don't think knowing that takes any of the magic away from it. I think it'd be hard to get away with that now because we're so used to a different technical approach where you're going to spot a dubbed in and voice more likely than you would when that kind of approach was much more common before. Also, the voices worked. I think Gosling and Stone are not professional singers, but I think the voices have a lot of character, and it sort of works to have the not quite entirely polished voices working. But I'm not underselling their singing skills. They're both quite good. But
Stone in particular is interesting in La La Land because she can sing. Like, she can belt. There's mm-hmm. there's video on the internet of her like in singing competitions when she's young. Like, and obviously in that big climactic audition number, mm-hmm. she, you know, gets that big moment. But for most of the film, she has this kind of like thready quality to her voice. And I've seen the suggestion, and I'm willing to buy it, that is kind of intentional, as her character being kind of reserved and holding back up until that moment, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's hard to say because
kind of growing into her voice. That makes sense. Yeah, I noticed that too on second viewing, especially. It's like she's finding gears in her in singing that she's not finding in the rest of the movie.
City of stars, just one thing everybody wants. Of the crowded restaurants, it's love. Yes, all we're looking for is love from someone else.
A rush,
a glance,
a touch,
a dance,
a look in somebody's eyes to light up the skies, to open the world and send me reeling. A voice that says I'll be here.
So, like, if that's a specific choice, I get that, and I guess I respect it, but I did kind of want some more, like, big musical singing in this movie. I'm not gonna lie. Like, if you're gonna go, like, full bore, big Hollywood musical, I feel like the singing has got to be there, and the dance scene's got to be there, and it's not quite there for both Gosling and Stone. Like, they're very proficient. They get through it well enough, and there is a certain kind of scrappy charm to the way they do it, but you know, they're not Fred and Ginger, you know, and that's maybe purposeful, but there's still a part of me that wants Fred and Ginger here.
Yeah,
you
I
know?
Mean, Chazelle said it is purposeful, but not quite professional quality to the dancing. I find it charming. It's certainly not Everyone Says I Love You, which was really uncomfortable musical numbers.
Those some charming. I mean, I remember one with Edward Norton in a jewelry shop that was nice because it was just playing. It was a choreographed dance number that played up his, you know, amateur dancing, and it was mm-hmm. you know, had a certain charm to it. But I think in a way you could say a couple of things. One, I think it would just have been a bridge too far for modern audiences to accept what was accepted very easily mm-hmm. In classic Hollywood when people saw musicals all the time, that they're not hearing the voices of the mm-hmm. actors, that they're being dubbed.
It would seem like a cheat.
Open it up and there's Justin Timberlake's voice.
right. So that would be a little bit tough. And I guess the other point is that maybe the film is let down by the fact that the songs are just pretty good. You know, that kind of stuck with me. I do like the songs. They are not brilliant songs that are going to stand the test of time, like, or numbers even, that are going to blow you away. And there's certainly nothing remotely close to the transcendence of Michel Legrand's at his best. I mean,
but they are discrete songs, which is something that you can't really say for most of Umbrellas outside of "I Will Wait for You." But that's kind of, again, more of a motif. But there aren't numbers in Umbrellas.
That's true.
You know,
it's a little unfair. But yeah. you know what I mean. What is going to trigger more of an emotional reaction from you just hearing it? The music from La La Land, or, you know, some of the key bits of Michel Legrand's score. To me, it's not. It is not close. It is not close. It is the French film that I like. One thing that we touched on a little bit in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is the location, which is a real location in Normandy. It's sort of a working class town that has been given a little bit of fairy dust by Demi, a lot more color, obviously.
But, just wallpapered the entire town.
And of course, this the LA that we see in La La Land is not necessarily the LA we know, and that's something that is introduced in the first sequence. So what did you make of the evocation of place?
Well, I mean, both of these films kind of have their settings in the title, more or less. Like, where they are set is important to the story both films are telling. And I think both settings kind of define the central relationships to a certain extent. Like, we talked about kind of the difference between me and Sebastian versus Guy and Genevieve, and sort of the disparity of ambition between them. And like, modern LA, you can't really tell a story about these kind of characters in modern LA without bringing those elements into the fold. And whereas Cherbourg is this small working class town in 1964, where a dream of opening a gas station is a realistic and appropriate dream for those characters, you know? So I think it's really important that both of these films evoke their setting and call to their setting as much as they do. I think La La Land does it much more strongly and self-consciously. I mean, that opening number, you know, and the Prius jokes and, you know, the various landmarks.
Yeah.
But, you know, Cherbourg is much more subtle and just kind of like living in that space rather than commenting on it. But they both, I think, depend on their setting quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, La La Land's like Hollywood's greatest hits, yeah. right? With the Griffith Observatory, and then you get what appears to be the Fox logo in the backdrop of one scene, right?
Yeah.
That's sunset.
Yeah, and you get the filmed in Hollywood, USA, at the end card, you know, there. And one thing I found interesting in La La Land is how, like, the way the setting was portrayed kind of, like, shifted along with Sebastian and Mia's relationship. In the autumn segment, where things are starting to go downhill, there's a short shot of Mia driving, and through the window you see the marquee of the Rialto, which is where they go to see Rebel Without a Cause on their first date, and it's been closed, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty on the nose, I'm not going to lie, but I think it's a really good example of how the setting functions to reflect what is happening in that relationship.
Yeah, and as I suggested before, the whole death of jazz, death of film, end of things, you know, there's a film's not at all subtly littered with the little bits of old Hollywood too. I like the mural with all the old Hollywood stars that they walk by a couple times. It reminded me of, did you ever see The Late Show, the Robert Benton movie?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a really fun movie, but it's sort of a take on classic Hollywood mysteries set in like 70s LA. So there's all these like crumbling remains of classic Hollywood. So I think there's a little bit of that in this. I mean, I thought it was neat. I liked that. I also, for all that, I would love to watch a epilogue to Los Angeles Place itself. It's sort of a weary walking through of all these locations and what awful abuse they make of Los Angeles. So,
just the fact that it's L.A., it would infuriate
Tom Anderson,
the director of that film.
If you don't know Los Angeles Plays itself, we talked about it at the Zob. It's a 3-hour-long look at Los Angeles as it's portrayed on film. That used to be a quasi-underground, and now it's widely available on Netflix and elsewhere.
It was a movie of the week, right?
It was a movie of the week. We had to watch it on YouTube because it wasn't legally available.
Can we just pat ourselves on the back and just say that we worked for a for-profit website in which we devoted a week of content to
Los Angeles Plays itself,
which you can only really watch in full on YouTube. But
the checks that Tom Anderson sent us
to do that was incredible. But I felt good about it. It got done. It happened. So The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is widely available on Blu-ray and DVD from Criterion as part of the great Jacques Demy box set. It's also streaming on Filmstruck and the usual places. La La Land is in theaters right now and will keep on expanding through the new year. And we'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show, in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Genevieve, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Well, I'm going to channel the spirit of Tasha Robinson, who always makes a point of recommending supplementary material in this segment. And I am going to suggest some Tasha-written pieces, since she's not here to stop me, related to La La Land.
She'd be blushing.
I know. Tasha is kind of on the La La Land beat over on The Verge, and I admit that I did comb through her pieces in preparation for this episode, so I would be remiss if I didn't call out two really great interviews she did. Tasha is a great interviewer, mm-hmm. and she talked to Damien Chazelle for The Verge, which is a great interview, but I would highly recommend her conversation with La La Land's choreographer, Mandy Moore, which gets into some really fun details and facts about how this movie was choreographed for the camera, which I know is something that's very interesting to you, Scott, and mm-hmm. It's just a great conversation. I would highly recommend checking it out. The name of the article is La La Land's Choreographer Shares the Film's Sneakiest Dance Movie References. That title's a little misleading. There's a lot more to it than that, obviously, since Tasha wrote it. So,
internet headlines.
Yep.
does she talk about the underwater sequence?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, about the underwater turned stars sequence. Mm-hmm. Yes. So definitely check that out. And then as far as a movie recommendation, I'm going to recommend something that has come and gone from theaters, but I have been, as I think most of have been, doing a lot of end of year catch up as we do our various end of year lists. And one that I caught up with and ended up making my top 10 of the year is Loving, Jeff Nichols's second film of this year after Midnight Special, which we did a show on earlier in the year. Mm-hmm. And Nichols had a really good year for me. I really liked both the films he did, but I think Loving is really extraordinary on a lot of levels, on an acting level, particularly Ruth Negga and Joel Edgerton as the couple whose marriage was the basis of a Supreme Court case that ended up overturning the ban on interracial marriage. They are both excellent in their roles and very understated performances. And I love that the movie just really focuses on their marriage and not on this history-making court case. It's all about how these two characters relate to each other and the emotions that are kind of driving this series of events. And it's out of theaters. I don't know if it's going to be in the awards conversation much. I think maybe Negga will be, mm-hmm. but I imagine it will be making its way onto DVD and streaming soon. So if you missed it, keep an eye out for it.
It's kind of mysterious that film didn't catch on more than it did.
Yeah, I'll throw one last plug in here. We talked about it extensively, Scott and I did, on the Film Spotting Top 10 episodes, which we were both guests on, and those will... The first part has already dropped, and the second part will be dropping a couple days after this episode drops.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, it was a solid 5-hour recording session. Yeah. I think we got through it fast, too. That's how it's a big, it's an epic show. It was very exciting to have Genevieve on. She's not done that, been part of that before. It was great.
Yeah, I feel like Loving kind of falls victim to being understated in some mm-hmm. ways. It's so beautifully subtle, so rich. Edgerton, does he have 30 lines of dialogue in the whole movie? And it's such a wonderful performance. Well, and Negga's great, too.
And that's true of Midnight Special, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that was, like, an understated science fiction movie that perhaps kind of suffered by being that in the wider audience's minds, you know? But Edgerton also had a very understated performance in that.
He's so good. I'm going to follow Jeff Nichols wherever he goes.
You know?
Why don't I just quickly? You're behind the curve. I'm going to be a little ahead of the curve here.
Okay.
Here's movies you can see that are terrific that are still coming up in theaters. I'm just going to list them off and talk a little about each. Silence, which we considered for our next episode. We reject it for our next episode. But I think it's a really, there's dissenting opinions out there, maybe even in this room. But I think it's a wonderfully intense meditation on fate for Martin Scorsese. Tony Erdmann, which debuted at Cannes last year. And it was like the one film that hadn't actually been released that crept onto the BBC's 100 Greatest Films of the 21st Century. And those of us who hadn't seen it at that point kind of scratched our heads. But it's a remarkable film. It's one of the strangest movies I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. It's a 2.5-hour plus comedy about a father trying to reconnect with his daughter through a series of pranks and disguises. by description there, it sounds unbearable, but it's a really wonderful film and moving in all kinds of strange, unexpected ways. I really like 20th Century Women. Mike Mills is virtually plotless, but wonderful.
It's like a memory dump.
Evocation of life in late 70s California. And the new Almodovar film, which I think kind of is kind of overlooked. I don't know if it's necessarily one of his best films, but I think it's very good. It's Julieta, and it's sort of this interesting mystery with no resolution, and ultimately the mystery is not where it lies. And it's a kind of a vague description. It's kind of in some ways a vague film, but one I admired a lot. And if you like the more serious Almodovar and more Hitchcock evoking Almodovar, it's one you're going to enjoy. So there you go, a bunch of movies to go out and see that aren't even in theaters yet as we record this.
I mean, I'm going to have to. Yeah, I will second that because you've just done quick hits on my number two and number three favorite films of the year. Two being Tony Erdmann and three being Silence. So both of which will take up plenty of your time. They're a little short of 3 hours. But
one is funnier immersive than the other.
That is true. That is true. And one is super austere and very Bergman-y. I'm going to go with something maybe not as essential, but worth watching. You know, for a recent Rolling Stone list on the best horror films of 2016, I volunteered to do a short write-up about The Invitation, which I used as my excuse to see the movie on Netflix. I did the same thing for I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, which I also really like, but I'm just going to talk about The Invitation here. The Invitation is a fascinating slow burn thriller from Karen Kusama, who made a splash back in 2000 with her debut feature Girl Fight. And in a year full of movies about parents grieving for the loss of their children, I'm not even going to say one of them because it's kind of a twist, but Arrival, say, or Collateral Beauty, The Invitation twists that grief into particularly dangerous form of denial. It's about a couple named Eden and David who invite a big group of friends to a dinner party in the Hollywood Hills, including Eden's ex-husband, with whom they lost their son. He's seeing her for the first time in over 2 years. They're led through a series of awkward party games, and they're evangelized to about this new agey therapy in Mexico where Eden has learned to compartmentalize the loss of her son. And the whole film, and really the evening for the guests, has that kind of frog and boiling water quality going, in which the heat is just turned up so slowly that they and you as a viewer don't realize quite how scalding it's getting. I like the build up to this film a little bit more than the payoff. The ending is kind of a Twilight Zone-y twist that I thought was pretty tacky, but getting there is a lot of fun and has a lot of fun little mini twists along the way and some great performances and style. So it's streaming on Netflix now, so it wouldn't be hard for you to see. So The Invitation.
Great. Yep. It's been I say this as someone who does not keep up with horror, but as someone who knows a lot of people who keep up with horror, it seems like it's been a pretty good or at least interesting year for the genre.
Definitely. I mean, The Witch was this year and Green Room, if you want to count that as a horror film, and a lot of little things. I thought Don't Breathe was outstanding for a studio horror machine. It doesn't get much better crafted than that. So a lot of good stuff to check out, and some it's a lot of good horror films on the radar. I would recommend kind of looking through that Rolling Stone list because I think the films on there are definitely worth a look.
All right, check it out.
And that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out January 10th and 12th. Keith, what do we have lined up?
For our next episode, we'll be taking a trip to the land of Jim Jarmusch, where the conversations are short, the shots are long, and the greatest song you've never heard is probably played on the jukebox. We'll be pairing Jarmusch's latest, Patterson, starring Adam Driver as a bus driver named Patterson in Patterson, New Jersey, with Jarmusch's 1984 breakthrough film, Stranger Than Paradise, in which a pair of New Yorkers and a Hungarian visitor go on a journey across America. Patterson is currently rolling out in theaters. Stranger Than Paradise is available on DVD and is also available streaming on Filmstruck and available for rent on other streaming services.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and La La Land and anything else film related. Maybe Arrival again. You got some more thoughts on Arrival? we want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days, Genevieve?
I am at Vox.com at the culture section there, mostly editing, but occasionally popping my head out to write. And I'm on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky.
I'm on Uproxx.com, a la Genevieve, mostly editing, occasionally writing. And I'm on Twitter at KFIPS3000.
I'm on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. And I'm writing like crazy. You can find my work all over the place at places like NPR and Variety, Guardian, New York Times, and other such fine outlets. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show via Twitter at Next Picture Pod, via Facebook at facebook.com/Next Picture Show, or by visiting nextpictureshow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And while you're there, think about rating and reviewing us. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keeps the show going. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance producing the show. And thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing this lovely recording space in her home base, her home. the Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.
So bring on the rebels, the ripples from pebbles.